You're heading south of the Mason-Dixon. This is the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. Here is your host, Brian McClanahan.
Welcome back to the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. This is your host, Brian McClanahan, and this is episode 66, covering the week of April 3rd through April 7th, 2017. Glad to have you back on the program. Glad to be here. Before we get started, let's do our little housekeeping we do every week. If you would like to share this podcast around, please do so on social media. You can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, like our YouTube page. You can also go to our webpage, abbevilleinstitute.org. Give us your email address, and we'll send you a daily dose of Dixie, along with any other announcements we have for the Institute. So you might want to do that. You also get a free ebook, Kirkpatrick Sales, Emancipation Hell. So you can pick that up just for shooting us an email address. Also remember that our summer school is coming up July 9th through 14th, 2017 in Seabrook Island, South Carolina. It's going to be a great event. There still are a few seats left. If you are a student, a graduate student, undergraduate student, or advanced high school student, and you would like to attend, we'd love to see you there. There are some scholarships available. So please go to our webpage and click on the event, which is in the middle of the page, and contact Dr. Livingston if you would like to attend. We have a great faculty, a great program, and so we'd like to see you there. Okay, that said, also one more thing. We do exist on your tax-deductible contributions alone, so if you would like to support the Abbeville Institute, if you'd like to support this podcast, if you'd like to support our mission, if you'd like to support our webpage or anything that we do, our programs, please consider making a tax-deductible contribution to the Abbeville Institute. It is the only way we keep the lights on, so we do need your support, and we appreciate your support. We have other things in mind that we want to do, so we'd love to have you help us explore what is true and valuable in the Southern tradition. Okay, so all of that said, let's talk about the week that was at the Abbeville Institute. So the theme for this week was generally the Republican Party, and I think it's current because we've seen in the last week or so, last 2 weeks, we've seen some interesting developments taking place in Washington, D.C. One of those is, it seems to be, the president, Donald Trump, flip-flopping on some of his campaign promises. One of those, of course, was the issue with the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. The other was foreign policy. So we've seen the Affordable Care Act go down in flames. We've also seen the Republican Party attempt to block a conservative Supreme Court justice from taking the bench. Barely went through by one vote in the Senate, so they had to take away the filibuster rule for judicial confirmations. And we've seen the bombing in Syria without any congressional approval. And this goes completely back on what Trump had said before he was president, while Barack Obama was president, and of course, how he campaigned for president. So we had a couple of pieces, of course, not knowing about the foreign policy event that was going to take place at the end of the week on Thursday. We had some pieces about the Republican Party almost foreshadowing exactly what was going to happen. So the South should be interested in principles. People in the South, and they always have been. I mean, there has been throughout much of Southern history this strain of principled defense of their core beliefs. And I mean, you go back to the old Republicans in the Jeffersonian period, and you look at those men and the things that they stood for, and that original Constitution, the positions that they took were consistent with the original Union, real federalism. And that particular idea has carried forward throughout almost all of Southern history. Now, the South wasn't alone in this in the early Federal Republic. There were also Northerners who were principled as well in this belief in real federalism, and that was a driving factor in their political philosophy. Of course, the South held on to it longer as the North began to cloak their sectionalism with this idea of nationalism. And so what we got in the 1850s was the Republican Party, which was a purely sectional party that spoke with nationalist language. And I think that's the important thing to understand about the Republican Party. It's always been a national party, and it's always been a northern-dominated party. When I say national, that's the language they use, but it's always been dominated by northerners. Always. even to this day, it still is. Even though the South has found the Republican Party to be the dominant party in that section, and most Southerners are Republicans, I think that, you know, as Clyde Wilson has been saying for over 30 years, you have to be very careful with that. Because the Republican Party never really has been a Southern party. And so this is the theme for this week was a look at principles and how the North really has continued to dominate the South, even through this supposed resurgence of conservatism in the United States. It just isn't the case. So we started the week with a piece by Tom Fleming written in 1982 entitled On Liberty. And it's a great little piece because it explains in so many words, in very few words, I should say, what the South believes. And so he talks about what liberty means to the South. And he says this, quote, "For the South, liberty was not a libertarian repudiation of standards. Every community has the right, no, the obligation, to set up and enforce a code of principles and behavior. Toleration of dissent does not require a neutral attitude toward vice." He says, "The principle of least government has caused most Southerners to refrain from interfering in private lives. In the midst of drawing up blue laws and legislating morality, we are usually careful to restrict the role of government to the public sphere. While New England Puritans were eager to spy on the private lives of citizens, sniffing out Sabbath breaking and moral turpitude, Southerners have usually chosen to ignore what goes on between consenting adults so long as it did not become a public scandal." And that's true. I mean, this is something that John Shelton Reed had pointed out. Now, we'd say the South is more libertarian, but these community standards gets down to the core of local self-government. And keeping your house set off the road so that no one sees what you're doing and... and you don't really care what somebody else is doing. And he says, you know, the South solves family problems at the family level, local problems at the local level, and state problems at the state level. It will reserve the federal marshal Supreme Court decisions and for problems that directly affect the nation as a whole. And he says, states' rights is only a particular affirmation of this general principle, one that is strongly rooted in the love of liberty. We do not need our states to tell us how to rear our children, and we do not need the Congress or the Supreme Court to tell us how to run things in Alabama or South Carolina, even when we are wrong. And he says, you know, Southern political life has always been centered on these paradoxes of freedom. All those dry counties with thriving moonshine operations, the slave owners who twice went to war to preserve their liberty, and the hard-shell Baptists who knew good and well that there was something a little funny about Cousin Seymour, but who would fight you if you said anything about him. He says the people has to earn liberty. They have to fight for it. So what's happened in the South is that they held on to these principles longer because it came down to this idea of local self-government, meaning that you sweep around your own doorstep and you watch what's going on in your own backyard, and you don't really care what's going on in some other section or some other place, some other city, some other state. You don't care about those things. And that's the important core of Southern liberty, this Southern principle. Now, Southerners gravitated toward the Republican Party because the Republican Party eventually started talking about these things. But it's interesting because Fleming also brought this up. Eventually, the South started dropping this idea of this community liberty or individual liberty as well, and they started thinking about themselves merely as class conscious. We had an upper class, a middle class. We had country club people and working class people, blue collar people. Southerners started thinking of themselves in that way, so they believed they had more in common with their Yankee brethren based on income and class than they did based on regional identification. And you started seeing that really by the 1970s into the 1980s. And I think that what happened in 2016 is that a lot of Southerners repudiated that. They started looking at themselves as, hey, look, we have interests. Our interests are this. And so we're going to vote for a guy that seemingly has those interests at heart. Now, this happened in the 1980s as well. You know, as Clyde Wilson will point out on the piece that ran on Wednesday. So we'll get into that. So what about the South? I mean, what is this idea of liberty? So Dr. Fleming gets into that. And then how does this manifest itself politically over time? How has this happened? So the piece on Tuesday was entitled A Question of Sovereignty, written by Ryan Walters, who will actually be one of the faculty members at the summer school. And essentially what he gets into is the original Constitution and who is sovereign in that. Are the people of the state sovereign, or is this national government, this abstraction of a national government sovereign? And essentially what Ryan Walters concludes is that, well, the people of the states are. The states are sovereign. The people of the states are sovereign. And so those people can make or unmake the government. And so secession, as he starts, he asks the question, is secession treason? And we've run a number of pieces on this particular idea on the website. He asks, you know, what is a sovereignty in the political sense of the term? Would it be far wrong to define it as a political community without a political superior? He says, tested by this, no one of our states except Texas was ever a sovereignty. And even Texas gave up that character on coming into the Union. But this is not necessarily the end all, the end of the story. And he says, but history tells a far different tale than that embraced by the lawyer from Springfield, meaning Lincoln. The states do enjoy a status far above mere provinces, which is essentially the position Lincoln assigned them. They did not gain their independence and liberty from a Union that had yet to exist. And many of the states not only framed state constitutions before the Union, they also began referring to themselves as states long before any Union, because the Articles of Confederation themselves, the first effort at Union, was not crafted until 1777 and did not go into effect until 1781. Now, of course, what Lincoln was doing in 1861 throughout the time that, you know, before 1865, was basically following up on the idea that John Marshall put forward in McCulloch v. Maryland, which was essentially that the only reason that we had state ratifying conventions is because we couldn't have one large convention of people to ratify the Constitution, but we, the people, created it. That's Marshall's argument, of course, so the people in the aggregate created the Union, not the people of the states. Of course, this is completely turning history on its head. So the founders, the founding generation, often looked at the Union as 13 sovereign bodies. As he points out, Oliver Ellsworth of Connecticut said they were. So everyone in the founding generation recognized that the Union was created by the states, and these states were sovereign. So he gets into this idea that, you know, there was no treason because the states were simply reverting back to their original status as sovereign entities when they seceded from the Union. And of course, that's important because what we're looking at here are political communities. Political communities that have a principle of liberty behind them, as Dr. Fleming pointed out. And that liberty was what was good for the community. It was individual liberty, but these communities then could determine for themselves what type of society they would have. And everyone wanted that in the founding period. You know, the people of Massachusetts didn't want the people of South Carolina governing them. They made that very clear in their state ratifying convention. And vice versa. And they were concerned in Massachusetts. Would South Carolina have a great role in their local self-government? And of course, it was argued in that Massachusetts ratifying convention that no, that would not be the case. And the same thing was said in South Carolina. No, the people of Massachusetts or Connecticut are not going to govern the people of South Carolina or the people of Virginia or Georgia. That's not going to happen because that union only has defined powers. And so this idea of liberty went back to the local level, the family level, the local level, the state level. Now, the Puritan concept of liberty was on power was the best of the community. You know, the community is over the individual. The South has always looked at the individual more than the community. But when you get things that are in the community interest, the South has long defended this idea of political communities that support individual liberty. The North, the Puritan idea of liberty was, the freedom from the tyranny of circumstance, or the freedom from fear and want. And so this, when Franklin Roosevelt said the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, he was reared in this very Puritan tradition. And so that was the center then, again, which is simply Northern sectionalism hiding behind nationalism. But the center would determine the rest. What's best for you will come from the central authority. The South has never really subscribed to that. So when we get to the Wednesday piece, and so again, Walter says secession was perfectly legal. There's no treason there. If you look at the history of the United States, and you look at the history of the states united, you look at the governing documents of the United States, this is very clear. So when you get to the modern era and you start looking at how Southerners have carried themselves politically, and you look at how they've been duped, essentially. And that's really the story of the last 30 years, how Southerners have been duped. Now, some of them were fine with this because they became these mainstream Republicans. But as Clyde points out, and this piece was written in 1982, he says, quote, "Let's face facts. Reagan was not elected president because he was Republican, but in spite of the fact that he was Republican." Now, just replace Reagan with Trump. And here we are with a broken record. Same old story. He says, "Consider that the president himself, a majority of the delegates who voted for him, at least two Republican national conventions, and a majority of the voters who support him at the election were former Democrats. Reagan succeeded only because he was able to leave behind the dead baggage of the Republican past and become a spokesman of the future." And essentially, that's what Trump was doing as well on the campaign trail. That's not how Trump is governing, but that's how he campaigned. And again, replace Reagan with Trump. "But in office, Mr. Reagan has surrounded himself at every level with and become the captive of professional Republicans. You have to hand it to the moderate Republicans. They have managed to hold on to their institutional power despite the fact of having lacked for more than a decade either any political principles or any grassroots support." And he says, "Consider that there are millions of social conservatives in this country, North and South, Democrat and Republican and Independent. There are millions of dedicated leftists of all stripes. There are not many country club Republicans. Their core strength can be placed at about half of John Anderson's vote. Yet this handful has managed to take over the Reagan victory," again, take Reagan out, put Trump, "and turn it from a conservative landslide into a liberal-Republican coronation." So you look at what's happening in 2017, and it's just a repeat of 1981 and 82. Look, and he says, "Look at the history of moderate Republicans. Since World War II, it has produced little but a series of mediocrities passed off as statesmen. Scranton, Romney, Rockefeller, Lodge, or for that matter, Eisenhower, Nixon, Ford, and Bush. These people never had any political principle, except the snobbish assumption that since they were prosperous northern WASPs, they were divinely entitled to rule the country. Their platform always boiled down to being in favor of whatever the Democrat left was in favor of, except a little less of it and run by different people themselves. You look at what happened with the Affordable Care Act. It was the American Care Act, whatever they called it. It was the Affordable Care Act light. That's all it was. They just stripped out a couple of things and left everything else, and that's what it was. And so again, replace Reagan with Trump. Had the establishment Republicans had their way, they'd have lost the election with Bush or Ford. Or, in this case, had the establishment Republicans had their way, they would have lost the election with Bush in 2016, or maybe Romney again. Or if they had won by some miracle, we would have had an administration notable only for its inability to generate any idea different from the Democrats. Again, you could have written this in 2017. So here we are, 35 years later, and we're talking about the exact same thing. This is when I said at the beginning of this podcast, the South has been duped for 35 years into believing somehow that the Republican Party is interested in the South. It's not. Maybe at the local level, maybe state level, but not definitely not at the federal level or at the general government. It never has been. Not since 1854 when the thing was founded. It's never really been interested in the South. But yet, Southerners vote for Republicans and they expect a different outcome. This is the definition of insanity. So the question is, what do you do? What do you do? And the piece on Thursday by the late Tom Landis, Republican Death Wish, got into this as well. And he was talking about the 1990s and how you had had this Republican revolution in the 1990s, but at the same time, everyone was dropping social issues. Now, Pat Buchanan capitalized on this in 2000, of course, in 1996, when he was making some waves against the Republican establishment. And really, he set up Donald Trump for 2016. But Trump didn't really care what the party establishment wanted when he was running for president. He shoved it back in their face. We're gonna emphasize things that are, that social conservatives like. I mean, for example, get into the issue of immigration. We're going to emphasize those things, and we're going to run with it. And so Tom Landis pointed out, he said, quote, Republican leaders are determined that by 1996, the so-called religious right will be tamed or exorcised. Then the party will be pared down to a lean army of defiant materialists who will do battle against Bill Clinton and the Democrats flying the banner of entrepreneurial capitalism. The strategy is based on the presumption that by the time the next presidential election rolls around, the economy will be in terrible shape, and Dole will pirouette into the White House singing the praises of the Laffer Curve. Of course, if the economy continues to prosper, and it's doing pretty well right now, there's always the year 2000. As for any Republican who wants to run on a platform calling for the restoration of policies that promote traditional values, the party is quick to pile on such a candidate and pummel him with fists and stout cudgels. And this is true. I mean, look at what happens when you have a social conservative or someone who's not the establishment running for office. The Republicans are more nasty than the Democrats. And he says, quote, the Republican leadership is playing a dangerous game, particularly in the South, which has never really embraced the party, even when voting for its candidates at the national and state level. And he says, meanwhile, Southern conservatives are increasingly disturbed with the drift of the nation. Some sensible folks are privately talking about secession. It's just talk, of course. But another alternative they frequently mention is more viable, a conservative third party. The Republican leadership is currently down on its knees begging for such a movement, one that will field an alternative candidate in 1996, some more principled than Bill Clinton or Bob Dole, or for that matter, Ross Perot. So, when he says the Republican leadership, what he's talking about there is the grassroots, really. This is where the Trump phenomenon was. And I mean, so this is why after we had this event on Thursday and the bombing of Syria, without any congressional approval whatsoever, a lot of Republicans in the grassroots are saying, Trump, what are you doing? You've embraced the establishment. What is going on here? Explain how that fit with your campaign pledge for a much more non-interventionist foreign policy. Explain how this is in the interest of the United States. Only the establishment wants these type of things. International warfare. On both sides, when people like John McCain and Hillary Clinton are coming to your defense, you're on the wrong side of the issue. You're on the wrong side of the issue. But this is exactly what's happening in 2017. So you talk about, so we have these principles of liberty that Dr. Fleming talked about. And then we have Ryan Walters looking at sovereignty and how these states are supposed to be these sovereign political communities. The people of the states are sovereign. And so we have, you know, the family, then the local, then the state, and then the general government. And we go to a position in the 1970s and 80s, really into the 1980s, where the Republican establishment betrayed the people that put him in power. We're seeing it again in 2017. We saw it in the 1990s. Where do Southerners have to wake up and say, you know what? That party, the Republican Party, is not in our best interest. We need to think about things at the state and local level. Again, this is the only way we're going to solve these issues, solve these problems. We need to clean out the corruption at the state and local level too, because it's there. It's all over the place. Southern states have been notorious for corruption since Reconstruction. We got to clean that out, get rid of that that cesspool that oftentimes our state governments have. We need to go back to real federalism, real moral leadership. When you have that, you have better government. And we need to think about dropping the Republican Party. The left has already started to do this in some places. There are people that are starting to abandon the Democrats. But the problem is with the left, I mean, they all unify on this principle of we love government. So their commitment to federalism and maybe a third party is going to be short-lived, because they realize that the government, it doesn't matter if they have a person even a little lighter than they are on heavy-handed government, it's still better than nothing. And so they often rally around this central authority, whereas those on the right tend to fear that and distrust that more than anything else. And so it's hard to create, you know, this idea, because you have the Republicans who do believe in a strong central government, as Clyde pointed out, just a little lighter than the Democrats. It just would do a little less things with them in control. In other words, Affordable Care Act light, Obamacare light. So this is a story of the history of the South. The South has been duped into believing the Republican Party has their interests at heart, or that leadership coming out of the Republican Party is pro-South. It's not really. Never really has been. It hasn't been for 35 years. But yet, Southerners continue to believe in it. So you have this solid South of Republicans, and they rally around whatever the Republican Party tells them to rally around. But is that always in the best interest of the South? Usually it's not. So that's the theme. And then, of course, you get to the piece on Friday, which was written by Gail Jarvis, Do You Know What It Means to Miss New Orleans? And it talks about how bad New Orleans has become in terms of crime. And this came from Democrat mayors. But the important thing is that these mayors are simply only interested in federal funding, and this idea of being looking good for the media. And so you had these Democrats who were essentially just echoing what the Republican Party had been echoing since the 1850s, 60s, 70s, 80s, into the 20th century. And it became very corrupt. And he says, Mitch Landrieu and the city council, aided by a complacent media, ignore the crime problem and poverty. They direct their attention instead to symbolic issues, currently the removal of longstanding Confederate monuments. So they're not really focusing on the real problem in New Orleans, which is poverty and crime. They're focusing on these things that don't really matter. And again, it's because we've gotten to a point where this northern view of America dominates. It's this idea of a proposition nation, which hasn't really ever existed. We're forgetting our principles. Handle local issues. Handle the issues of the family. Take care of these things. A lot of times these social issues shouldn't really be handled by government, but people want to vote for people that are going to be sympathetic to, hey, look, I'm going to sweep around my own back porch. And we're also going to try to straighten up our communities with real rock-solid ideas that are going to help. We need the family to be important. You need your family to be front and center. These are things that matter. But That's never mattered to the establishment. It's never really mattered to the sectional party cloaking itself as a national party, the Republican Party. Corruption has always been their MO. They've brought it wherever they've gone. They've only wanted to do things a little lighter than the other side. And really, I mean, Southerners haven't had a political home in a very long time. So we vote for people that are often don't have our best interests at heart. They simply want to, push an agenda that the establishment will get behind. Foreign policy, domestic policy, it doesn't really matter. The establishment has shown, again, in 2017, that you cannot get rid of them. They're there. They're ingrained. They're ingrained in the Republican Party. They're ingrained in the Democratic Party. So what do you do? I think, Tom Landis talked about it, a real third party. Now, of course, the counter to that is, well, if we did that, then we're never going to win any elections. The Democrats will just continue to win, or the left will continue to win. You have to argue, well, the left continues to win anyways. The nationalists continue to win no matter what. They won in 2016 because they're the ones in power now. The last couple of weeks has shown that. Even with the confirmation of Neil Gorsuch, who knows what he's going to do on the bench. The Supreme Court has never been the savior of real conservatives in America. Even when that happens, the establishment tried to block that because they thought he was too conservative. 51 votes. And I dare say probably most of the votes, I didn't look at it, but most of the votes came out of the South for that. So that was good. But you have the establishment trying to block it. The establishment was all for Trump's unilateral action in Syria, which could involve the United States in a much bigger war. This is dangerous. We're playing a very dangerous game in Asia, playing a very dangerous game in the Middle East. And a belligerent attitude, which fits the neoconservative principles quite well, and the Republican establishment, is going to get the United States involved in another war. And who does most of the fighting and dying? Still the largest percentage of soldiers in the U.S. Army and sailors in the Navy and airmen in the Air Force come out of the South. So if it wasn't for the South to rely on this very martial attitude in the South, these belligerent Republicans would have no one to fight their wars for them. So you have to question, what is the best interest of the South in this process? What has always been the best interest of the South? And it hasn't typically been the establishment Republican leadership. We're in a broken record. 1982 is 2017. And I think that's something we need to start thinking about in the South as we think about principles and values, liberty. How do you ensure those things? How does a Southern idea continue to win when the Republican establishment will never lessen its grip on power? So I hope you enjoyed this week of the Abbeville Institute and this podcast. Until next time, good day.